to pass on the plenitude of racial types that they ate, carried in their genes from the antediluvian age, which they couldn't do under the moral standards of modern Baptists. I read somewhere about a senator. I don't know if it was true or not, but I read somewhere about a senator that was a philanderer in Washington who was criticized. His ambition was to make it with 1,000 women before he died. Well, he only had 70 years and probably wore out sooner. Noah had 350 years after the flood, and Shem had 502. Now, I'm not going to get into this in detail tonight. Sorry. But if Ham was down in Egypt, and Shem followed him there to try to carry out the task of keeping the races of man from totally deteriorating, and the descendants of the cursed one Cush taken over in their rebellion against God and confounding the religions of mankind, where is Noah? Oh, I'm going to talk about vice. Well, vice will keep for a few minutes. Yeah, there's vice. Oh, there. It was Arthur Evans, an Englishman. Now I'm in Gods, Graves, and Scholars. The Story of Archaeology by C.W. Saram. How many of you have copies of that? How many of you have memorized it? It was Arthur Evans, an Englishman, who succeeded in revealing fully the Minoan culture glimpsed by Schliemann, born in 1851, interesting date. Evans was 39 years old when a great German student of antiquity died. Schliemann had not only uncovered Troy and the ancient Greek civilization in many places, he had caught glimpses of another remarkable culture called the Minoan. Evans was the complete antithesis of Schliemann. Educated at Harrow, Oxford, and Göttingen, he became interested in hieroglyphics and found certain characters that pointed to Crete. There he began to dig in 1900. Am I going to get back to vice? The answer is yes. The importance of vice is, if he disproves that Khufu, or Cheops, the Greek name, necessarily built the pyramid, then it's open to other choices. Ham, which I doubt. Shem, with plans carried through the flood from Enoch. Noah. Or Enoch. Enoch's signature is in the pyramid. In the Enoch circle. Not his name. And all the ancients of Egypt pointed to Enoch as the source of the pyramid. Now, if Khufu built it, he lived a long time after Enoch. If it was there when Khufu came, then we got some more options. And where was Noah? Evans was a complete antithesis of Schliemann. He began to dig in 1900. In 1909, he was made extraordinary professor of prehistoric archaeology at Oxford, steadily rose to become the acknowledged authority in his field, was knighted and showered with honors to the end, receiving the Distinguished Copley Medal of the Royal Society as late as 1936 when he was 85. Now, Noah was just getting started, and Shem wasn't even wound up. At 85. In a word, he was in character and education the exact opposite of the roving, impetuous German Schliemann. But for all the respectability of his career, the results of his researches are no less interesting. He had come to Crete to confirm his theory of hieroglyphic interpretation. He had not expected to stay long. But he wandered over the island and saw the vast piles of rubble and ruins that had fascinated Schliemann before him. And one day, he laid aside his theories about the origin of writing and reached for a spade. A year later, in 1901, he announced that he would need at least another 12 months to lay bare everything of archaeological interest. He was mistaken. A quarter of a century later, he was still digging on the very same spot. Like Schliemann, Evans was guided in his quest for buried cultures by old legends and old folklore. Like Schliemann, he dug up palaces and treasures. He provided the frame for the picture Schliemann had drawn and added sketches of his own for many more pictures in which we've not yet filled in the colors. Crete lies on the periphery of a great curve of mountains running from Greece through the Aegean Sea to Asia Minor. The sea, in which these peaks are drowned, did not, as one might think, act as a cultural barrier. Schliemann had demonstrated this fact when he found objects at Mycenae and Tyrrhenes that must have come from distant parts. Later, Evans found ivory from Africa and statuary from Egypt on the island of Crete. Commerce and war are the prime movers of social intercourse. In this regard, the little world of antiquity was no different from the greater world of today. The islands of the Aegean were culturally and economically coextensive with their two motherlands, with their motherlands. Motherland, in this case, was not a continental entity. The real matrix of the ancient Aegean culture, its creative source, may have been one of the islands in the complex, namely Crete. How many of you here have been to Crete? Just you and me, Craig? Why are they waiting for you to deliver on Craig, on Crete? Did you leave promising to bring some things back to them? According to myth, Zeus himself was born on Crete, of Rhea, the Earth Mother. Now, Rhea is just another name for Semiramis. In a cave on Mount Ida, he was nourished with honey brought him by bees. This is the legend. The goat Almathea gave him suck from her udders, and he was attended the while by nymphs. Youths of military age banded together to protect him from his own father. The child eater, Cronus. Now, Cronus in a lot of cultures is none other than Nimrod. I just gave you that. According to Hislop. Minos is said to have ruled Crete. Minos, the legendary king, son of ancient Zeus, a figure regarded with awe by the ancients. Evans dug at Knossos. The masonry walls lay close to the surface of the ground. A few hours of work sufficed to yield some results. After a few weeks, the astonished Evans found himself looking at the remains of buildings covering an area of 8,480 square feet. That's a lot. As the year passed, the ruins of a palace extending over an area of 2.5 hectares, equaling 5.5 acres, was exposed. The ground plan of the structure was clearly defined and showed a certain relationship with the palaces of Tyrrhenes and Mycenae. But the greater massiveness and splendor of the Cretan building strongly suggested that Crete had been the cultural headquarters. Whereas the mainland citadels of Mycenae and Tyrrhenes had been the capitals of outlying provinces or colonies of Crete. About the gigantic rectangle of the largest courtyard on all sides rose the wings of various buildings, their walls made up of stone rubble, their flat roofs held up by columns. Here's a reconstruction of the South Palace steps. The rooms, corridors, and halls of the various stores were laid according to a confusing plan. So many were the opportunities to go astray in moving from room to room that the term labyrinth came naturally to mind, even to those who had no inkling of the legend surrounding King Minos. This legend tells of a labyrinth built by Daedalus for Minos, a model for all subsequent structures of its kind. Evans promptly announced to the world that he had found the palace of Minos. Son of Zeus, father of Adriadne, and Phaedra, master of the labyrinth and of the terrible monster, the Minotaur that it housed, or the Minotaur. Thereafter, he revealed a whole series of wonders. The people who had lived in Knossos, a people known to Schliemann only by their colonial offshoots and to the world at large only as described in legend, had evidently reveled in riches and lived lives of elegant debauchery. At the height of their development, they had apparently reached a state of sybaritic decadence that contained the seeds of decline. For those who habitually lie in bed, even on a mattress of rose petals, in time will suffer from sores. An economic golden age made this decadent culture possible. Then, as today, Crete was a land of wine and olive oil. But in its ancient heyday, it was a commercial center, an island entrepôt for the Aegean area. A puzzling fact was gradually revealed by the excavations. The most pretentious palace of Greek prehistory, Aegean prehistory, the springboard of the colonies in Tyrenes and Mycenae. This most pretentious palace of Greek prehistory had completely lacked any sort of protective walls or fortifications. The paradox was resolved by the discovery of the relics of a Cretan fleet, useful both in commerce and as a mobile weapon to repel invaders, a weapon more effective than static defenses. The palace of Minos did not look like a fortress to the seafarers of the period as they sailed into the harbor of Knossos. They saw it as a marvel of the coast. Its columns were chalky white. Its decorated walls shone under a burning Cretan sun. It was a maritime jewel, flaunting Crete's riches and superiority from every sparkling facet. Evans discovered, among other things, the old storerooms of Knossos. In them were rows of huge vase-like oil containers, richly ornamented vessels, elegantly decorated in a style already known from Schliemann's digs at Tyrenes. Evans took the trouble to measure the capacity of this oil store and judged it to be about 19,000 gallons. And this was the oil supply for a single palace. Who were the beneficiaries of this opulence? You don't care. Who were the beneficiaries of this opulence? Too cold in here. Who were the beneficiaries of this opulence? Who were the beneficiaries of this opulence? You don't think I'm going to finish. Keep going, do you? You think I'm going to quit, don't you? For shame. Who were the beneficiaries of this opulence? Presently, Evans discovered that his finds did not all stem from the same period. Walls were of various ages. The ceramics and paintings showed a variety of styles, and after making a close survey of Cretan artifacts, Evans was able, he believed, to distinguish the different periods of the cultural whole. He divided Cretan history into three parts: an early Minoan period from 3000 to 2000 B.C. Now let's figure out. They came out of Egypt's bondage about 1453, something like that. That was the fourth generation, so that takes us back to 1800 to 2000 for Abraham's sortie in Palestine. Abram was about 75 when he left Haran. So it takes us back to about 2000 to Nimrod's heyday and the latter part of it in Ur. Takes us back another couple hundred years to the flood. Huh? So we're back somewhere between 2000 and 2500 B.C. for the flood, right? If the genealogies of the Bible are correct. Early Minoan period from 3000 to 2000 B.C., if they were affected by the flood, 500 years doesn't mean a dang thing in dates that far back. So the early Minoan period could have been the first culture right after the flood. Right? Well, that's interesting. Because when George Smith began to decipher the finds of Nineveh, to his amazement, he found broken pieces from that great library that, as he began to decipher it, obviously represented a Babylonian version of the flood. He didn't have all the pieces, and the commission was obtained for another search, and one of the great miracles of archaeology, they found matching pieces. And the Gilgamesh epic broke on the scene and stirred archaeology as probably no other find. It received so much attention that other things dimmed alongside it. It was many years before they began to sort out minor, by comparison, archaeological data, which include simple little reports from border guards in Assyria that helped in the middle and late 1800s to identify the names of the transplanted house of Israel in their resettlement villages in eastern Assyria. But the Gilgamesh epic was front page. In it, Gilgamesh seeks to find eternal life. First Ponce de Leon. And he's told that he can get the answer from the head of the family the survivor of the flood. And he goes looking for him. All right? Ut napishtam. The friendly God here in a dream had revealed the God's punitive intent in this so-called variation on the biblical legend of the flood. Utnapishtim indeed was none other than Noah. And the following is the text of that section of Gilgamesh concerned with Utnapishtim. The friendly God Ea in a dream had revealed the God's punitive intent to Utnapishtim, Ea's protege, whereupon Utnapishtim decided to build himself an ark. Quote, "What I had loaded thereon, the whole harvest of life, I caused to embark within the vessel, all my family and my relations, the beasts of the field, the cattle of the field, the craftsmen, and made them all embark. I entered the vessel and closed the door. When the young dawn gleamed forth from the foundations of heaven, a black cloud arose. All that is bright is turned into darkness. The brother seeth his brother no more. The folk of the skies can no longer recognize each other. The gods feared the flood. They fled. They climbed into the heaven of Anu. The gods crouched like a dog on the wall. They lay down." On it goes. And as the story unfolds, Gilgamesh went seeking Utnapishtim, Noah. He came to what is now Lebanon. And he performed a television evangelist deed. He found a girl. And when he revealed his quest, she told him that Utnapishtim lived on an island to the west. And he got in a boat and went looking for him. That's on the seacoast of Lebanon, heading toward Crete. As I said earlier, you will find when you get closer to the Babylonian source and trace the names of Bel and Baal and their root etymological meanings, they were the names of Cush. You get further from the source of the legend and you will find Baal and Bel because of their deified role also applied to the sun. And you'll find Baal and Bel as the name of what is in another culture Nimrod rather than his father Cush. You'll also find the same things with these other names. And because, as in the ancient Babylonian legends, you find Nimrod both the father and the husband and the son of Semiramis in some of the legends, and Nimrod as the sun being incarnated, who when he dies becomes the sun, and to justify a late birth of a son, Semiramis in her self-deification claims she is made pregnant by a sunbeam, and Tammuz is but the rebirth of Nimrod, which will explain why sometimes the names will interchange from father to husband to son. One of the most interesting studies to take all the legends and show all these interchanges, which Hyslop does in part. The same is true of Zeus. You'll find him occasionally linked to other of these deities who came down from the mountain. The stronger and most constant deity is the one who took over dominance, namely the woman image, Semiramis, who began to dominate and develop the worship more than Nimrod himself had. So in the legends of Crete, you find Zeus and Cronus wed Dorea, who is Semiramis in a new culture. And by those legends, if there is a basis in fact, either Nimrod was on that island, or if the Gilgamesh epic is true, Noah was on that island. Nimrod being in the grandson line through Ham, and Noah still living and going strong. Did Noah build this culture on Crete? And do the scripts of Linear A predate the division of the tongues? Remember, Noah and Shem could still speak the language that was common before the confusion of tongues at Babel, brought about by the initial work of Cush, finished by Nimrod. Are you interested in this at all?
Yes, sir.
Now, you got to admit that they are the most logical boat builders. All right?
Yes, sir.
And this great culture that planted its colonies, that pre-Evans was assumed to be beginning in the peninsula of Greece, those were colonies of Crete. Did Noah build his great palace on Crete, guard it with his ships, and retire in splendor while his son's down in Egypt? And what's Shem doing? If you want me to continue, hello! Just joined a whole bunch of people. If you want me to continue, well, obviously, they don't know what I'm continuing. Do the rest of you want me to continue on any of this at all? Because I'm coming up to the pyramids. Huh? You know what you have to do before I continue? Huh? And if you don't do it well, without me telling you what it is I need you to do, I ain't going to continue. Now, if you talk fast and write on the phones, I can go back to teaching. Reading from Alexander Hislop, The Two Babylons. I'm going to take any more calls for a while. The amazing extent of the worship of Nimrod indicates something very extraordinary in his character. And there is ample reason to believe And by the way, one of his names is the same root word that you encounter in Daniel 11, describing the God that Antichrist empowered with the same demon that empowered Alexander the Great worshipped. I threw that in. That demon's been around a long time to oppose God. There is ample reason to believe that in his own day, Nimrod was an object of high popularity. Although by setting up as king, Nimrod invaded the patriarchal system and abridged the liberties of mankind, yet he was held by many to have conferred benefits upon them that amply indemnified them for the loss of their liberties and covered him with glory and renown. By the time he appeared, the wild beasts of the forest multiplying more rapidly than the human race, must have committed great depredations on the scattered and straggling populations of the earth, and must have inspired great terror into the minds of men. The danger arising to the lives of men from such a source as this, when population is scanty, is implied in the reason given by God himself for not driving out the doomed Canaanites before Israel at once, though the measure of their iniquity was full, as described in Exodus 23, quote, "I will not drive them out from before thee in 1 year, lest the land become desolate and the beasts of the field multiply against thee. By little and little I will drive them out from before thee until thou be increased," end quote. The exploits of Nimrod, therefore, in hunting down the wild beasts of the field, and if the apocryphal scripture is correct, using that power of the skins that have been stolen, those exploits, ridding the world of monsters, must have gained for him the character of a preeminent benefactor of his race. By this mean, not less than by the bands he trained, was his power acquired when he first began to be mighty upon the earth. And in the same way, no doubt, was that power consolidated. Then over and above, as the first great city builder after the flood, by gathering men together in masses and surrounding them with walls, he did still more to enable them to pass their days in security, free from the alarms to which they had been exposed in their scattered life, when no one could tell but that at any moment he might be called to engage in deadly conflict with prowling wild beasts in defense of his own life and those who were dear to him. When the battlements of a fortified city were within it, no such danger from savage animals was to be dreaded. And for the security afforded in this way, and if you look at Diana and the various images of Semiramis, you will find those towers on their heads and the emblems associating her with the great builder of fortifications. Within the battlements of a fortified city, no such danger from savage animals was to be dreaded. And for the security afforded in this way, men no doubt looked upon themselves as greatly indebted to Nimrod. No wonder, therefore, that the name of the mighty hunter, who was at the same time the prototype of the god of fortification, should become a name of renown. Had Nimrod gained renown only thusly, it had been well, but not content with delivering men from the fear of wild beasts, he set to work also to emancipate them from that fear of the Lord, which his brothers peddled, in his view. For this very thing he seems to have gained as one of the titles by which men delighted to honor him, the title of the Emancipator or Deliverer. That name is the name of Pharaonius, another name for Zeus. The era of Pharaonius is exactly the era of Nimrod. He lived about the time when men had used one speech, when the confusion of tongues began, and when mankind was scattered abroad. Pharaonius is said to have been the first that gathered mankind into communities, the first of mortals that reigned, and the first that offered idolatrous sacrifices. This character can agree with none but that of Nimrod. Now, the name given to him in connection with his, quote, gathering men together, end quote, and offering idolatrous sacrifice is very significant. Pharaonius, in one of its meanings, and that one of the most natural, signifies the apostate. From Pharaoh, also pronounced Pharang or Pharong, which means to cast off or make naked, to apostatize, to set free. That name had very likely been given him by the uninfected portion of the sons of Noah. But that name had also another meaning, to set free. And therefore his own adherents adopted it and glorified the great apostate from the primeval faith, though he was the first that abridged the liberties of mankind as the grand emancipator, setting them free from the fear of God. And hence, in one form or other, this title was handed down to his deified successors as a title of honor. Thus we read Zeus Aphesio, that is Jupiter Liberator, and Dionysus Eleutherius, or Bacchus the Deliverer. The name Theseus seems to have had the same origin, from a word meaning to loosen. The temple of Theseus was allowed the privilege of being a sanctuary for slaves. And all those of mean condition that fled from the persecution of men in power. And the memory of Theseus while he lived was a sister of the distressed. All tradition from the earliest times bears testimony to the apostasy of Nimrod and to his success in leading men away from the patriarchal faith and delivering their minds from that awe of God and fear of judgment of heaven that must have rested on them while yet carrying fresh the memory of the flood most recent. And according to all the principles of depraved human nature, this too, no doubt, was one grand element in his fame. How great was the boon conferred by Nimrod on the human race in the estimation of ungodly men? By emancipating them from the impressions of true religion and putting the authority of heaven to a distance from them, we find most vividly described in a Polynesian tradition that carries its own evidence with it. John Williams, the well-known missionary, tells us that according to one of the ancient traditions of the islanders of the South Seas, the heavens were originally so close to the earth that men could not walk, but were compelled to crawl under them. This was found a very serious evil, but at length an individual conceived the sublime idea of elevating the heavens to a more convenient height. For this purpose, he put forth his utmost energy and, with the first effort, raised them to the top of a tender plant called TV, about 4 feet high. There he deposited them until he was refreshed, when by a second effort he lifted them to the height of a tree called Kauriki, which is as large as a sycamore. With a third attempt, he carried them to the summits of the mountains, and after a long interval of repose and by a most prodigious effort, he elevated them to their present situation. For this, as a mighty benefactor of mankind, he drove heaven up. This individual was deified, and up to the moment that Christianity was embraced, the inhabitants of those islands worshipped him as the elevator of the heavens. Now, what could more graphically describe the position of mankind soon after the flood and the proceedings of Nimrod as Pharaonius, the emancipator? Than this Polynesian fable. To maintain the union between heaven and earth, keep it as close as possible, was the aim of Noah's other sons. Nimrod set him free from this bondage. He thus becomes the Atlas who holds up the heavens. In another legend. Oh, you want me to quit? No. Get on the telephone. You look bored to me. No. Music. Most of the studies of ancient Egypt borrow from the position that Herodotus, the father of Greek history, borrowed from. Lights. An ancient priest in Egypt, Manetho, who compiled a king list. And he studied the dynasties of Egypt. They will trace those king lists true to Manetho. And every source without an exception that I know of in the scholarly world, begins the history of the kingdoms of Egypt with Menes. They have the pre-dynastic periods, which will go back to Paleolithic and Neolithic and Chalcolithic, and then they'll come to the dynasties that always start with Menes or Narmer. They'll come down to the fourth dynasty, Sneferu, Cheops, Chephren, Mycerinus, the so-called builders of the pyramids, which Colonel Weiss established with his forgery, as we say. And you can't find hardly a book that doesn't bow to Manetho and Weiss. Now, when we looked at the dating of the ages of the patriarchs in the King James and Genesis, we had Shem living 502 years after the flood, Noah living 350 years after the flood, if you go to 21st chapter of Genesis, you'll find the fifth verse. Abram was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born. Noah had been dead, therefore, 22 years. Shem still had 130 years to go when Isaac was born. When Abram died, we can't be too sure because the record speaks of three sons being born when Terah was 70 years old. But if you assume Abram born in the 70th year, which is not an absolute valid assumption,